We're studying about King Saul, the reign of King Saul over the nation of Israel. We know that he's the first of the kings of the nation of Israel. And that was according to what Moses had told them that they would do as they came through the wilderness, that they would one day ask for a king. And the reason was that they would be like the other nations round about them. And when they asked Samuel to appoint for them a king, Samuel told them, here's what having a king will mean. He'll take your sons and he'll make chariot drivers out of them. They'll be soldiers. And he'll take your daughters and they'll be bakers and perfumers and things of that nature. And we see that's precisely what King Saul did. But their attitude was when Samuel warned them about those things, oh, but we'll have a king. We'll be like the nations round about us. And sometimes our desire to be like everybody else gets us into trouble. And so it did with them. During the reign of King Saul, he became very arrogant. He started out very humble and things appeared to be very good. But he eventually became very arrogant after some successes. We note that as he was successful in conquering the Moabites and the Ammonites, the Edomites, and the Philistines to some degree, and then the Amalekites, we see in chapter 14. In chapter 15, we read of a real blunder of Saul as he was instructed to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And he brought back the best of the Amalekites and did not destroy them, but rather blamed the people and said the people wanted to bring them back to make a sacrifice out of them. And we talked about that in some detail. We talked about Saul's effort to offer a sacrifice in 1 Samuel chapter 13. And we also talked briefly about Saul's son, Jonathan, how that during the time when the Philistines presented a threat to the Israelites, it was Saul's son, Jonathan, that got together with his armor bearer and attacked the garrison of the Philistines and really enthused the Israelites and those who were fleeing. Began to rally, and they began to oppose the Philistines. And all seemed to be good, except Saul's attitude towards submitting to what God said. God had not required a sacrifice of King Saul. God had said to utterly destroy Amalek and the Amalekites, and Esau Agag and the Amalekites. And the reason was given why. Why was Saul to do that? We know earlier that they were to be destroyed. Moses had revealed that. And why? All right, this was divine retribution, if you please, to be carried out now by King Saul. Well, Samuel told Saul that you've not obeyed the Lord, and so consequently you'll be rejected from being king, that God could have established your lineage, but he's not going to do that. In fact, he's seeking someone after his own heart. And we note that Samuel mourned for Saul, and from that day forward didn't see him anymore. In chapter 16, we note that Saul, or rather David, is anointed to be king. In chapter 17, we note the challenge of Goliath, the Philistine, and how that David responded to that challenge and went out to fight the Philistine. And we're well familiar with that, how that David was victorious over the Philistine and somewhat so encouraged Saul when he would become down or depressed by playing music on the harp for him. And of course, now we're into the text of chapter 18 and chapter 19. And I want to pause here just a little bit and notice some things in chapter 18 that are said about David. What is it that is being rumored about David, in fact, becoming quite popular about David? Yeah, go ahead, Donna. Well, his countenance, this is true, but What about his efforts in battle? He's an all-around guy. Yeah. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. How did Saul take to that? Not very well. In fact, he wanted to kill David. In fact, when you read at verse 10 of chapter 18, when David played with his hands, as he did day by day, Saul threw his spear at him and tried to nail him to the wall. Literally tried to nail him to the wall. We note that Saul appointed David to be a captain. Now, we've learned in New Testament studies that a captain has how many soldiers under him? A centurion has 100, but a captain has 1,000 soldiers. Now, David being appointed to be captain was not so much an honor, as it were, to place him in greater risk. What was it that Saul hoped would happen to David? He'd be killed in battle. That's right. His desire was, in particular, that he'd be killed in battle with the Philistines. In fact, if you'll note in verse 17 of chapter 18, Saul said to David, "Behold, my elder daughter, Merib, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight Jehovah's battles. For Saul said, let not my hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." So Saul's desire was to put David right out there in the heat of the battle as a captain, and hopefully he'd be killed by the Philistines. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, deja vu. Exactly right. Well, when it came time for David to be married to Saul's daughter, Merib, what happened to Merib? She married somebody else. Well, then how did David... Well, David said, verse 18, unto Saul, "Who am I and what is my life, or my family, or father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But it came to pass at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel, the Maholathite, to wife. So, granted, David didn't consider himself worthy to be the king's son-in-law, but that didn't nullify the deal that Saul had offered. Now, Michal was to become David's wife. The text tells us in verse 20 that she loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And Saul said, "I will give him her that she may be a snare to him." This is verse 21. "And that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Wherefore Saul said to David, "Thou shalt this day be my son-in-law a second time." Now that's interesting, Jenny. He did. He did indeed. Well, you'd like to think so as you turn back to chapter 17. In verse 25, "The men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel he has come up, and it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel." So yes, David was in line to receive these blessings if he would fight against the Philistines. But when it came time for Saul to make good on this first daughter, he didn't make good. But he made good on the second daughter only with the intent that she would be a snare to David and get him killed among the Philistines. Well, he was but a youth, that is true. Well, perhaps so. He may have chosen not to. I gathered that Saul just didn't do what he said he would do. But what we do know is that Saul's intent toward David was never good. It wasn't good. His desire was to hurt him. And so we see in his intent to allow Michal to become David's wife was that she would be a snare to him. Yes. Well, could be. We know that Saul was not the most trustworthy fellow when it came to David. You mean politics? Surely not. Hard to believe. What? Why is Saul running around being king? Well, because he hasn't died yet, basically. That will soon end. He has rejected his lineage from being king and rejected him from being king. But he's still God's anointed. David, though he has been anointed by Samuel to be king, he's not taken the position yet. And there's some things that come to play. We'll read about them concerning the Philistines. Yes, Jenny?
I've never really been in the heart of a monarchy, but I've watched movies with them. And so it seems to me like what David is saying, who am I and what is my life or my father's family that I should be sending lots of people? That's just how you talk to a king.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now that's all very interesting and quite authoritative for your sources there. But what I want to note is, as you'll see the thought continue in verse 22, Saul commanded his servants, saying, commune with the king, commune with David secretly, and say, behold, the king hath delight in thee. Well, did he have delight in David? No. But that's what you say to him. And all his servants love thee. Well, did they all love him? No. Now therefore, be the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spake those words in the ears of David. And David said, seemeth it to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? And the servants of Saul told him, saying, on this manner spake David. And Saul said, thus shall ye say to David, the king desireth not any dowry. Let's pause right there. David's saying the same thing about Michal. You know, who am I? I'm just a little fellow that I should be the king's son-in-law. You're coming to me and you're saying you love me. You tell me the servants of the king love me. You tell me how Saul loves me and how he thinks so highly of me. And all. I'm just low man on the totem pole. And now Saul sends a message to David that, you know, this doesn't come at a small expense. What I want you to do is I want you to fight with the Philistines, and the text says bring 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Now in order to do that and bring these to King Saul, it's going to be necessary to kill 100 of the Philistines. And that's not going to go over very well with the Philistines, you know. However, David, in his desire to please the king, David's loyalty to Saul is not to be questioned. Certainly not here. But what we see regarding David, it says in verse 26, when the servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. And the days were not expired. And David arose and went, he and his men, and slew of the Philistines 200 men. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might be the king's son-in-law. Now, Mr. King Saul, you going to squelch on this deal? You see, first, it was a matter of your word. It's my judgment he squelched on that. Second, it's a matter of your word with Michal. But now you've made it the price of 100 of the Philistines. Now here's double the price. You going to squelch now? What would it appear that King Saul is bound to do? Yes. Yes. Saul's messing up. He's not to be trusted. I mean, we've already seen that he threw the spear at David and tried to nail him to the wall. That's once. Mark it down. We're counting. Yeah. Yeah. Anything. Now, in verse 28, it tells us, or verse 27, and Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, to wife. What else can he do? Now, we're going to see that he's not very honorable about that either a little bit later in this exchange. But in verse 28, Saul saw and knew that Jehovah was with David, and Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul was David's enemy continually. What did David do? How did he respond to that? Did he likewise hate Saul? All right, more wisely. He behaved more wisely. Even in his dealings in the next verse, you'll see with the Philistines. He behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. What's that mean? You could trust him. David's name is honorable. People believe David. They're willing to follow David. He has, as it were, the beginning of a following. Now, in chapter 19, I guess I should push this button every once in a while and catch ourselves up with what we have. In chapter 18, let's see, we've looked at verse 17, where, yes, we talked about that, his desire, and then in verse 25, we talked about that. Okay, well, I'm caught up with that chart. First admired by Saul, caught up with that. And then tries to kill David by throwing his javelin or spear at him. Well, we talked about that from chapter 18, verse 11. We implied, David, that that's one of three times, actually, that he tried to kill David. In chapter 19, in verses 9 through 10, we see that he tried once again to nail him to the wall, but he missed, and David was able to slip away. But the context of the 19th chapter is an interesting one as it begins with Jonathan and David. Now, we know that Jonathan and David have become the best of friends, have they not? And Jonathan is concerned about David's life, and rightly so. So, his view is that if my father is going to make a plot to kill you, and I find out about it, then I'm going to try to help you. So his idea was that he would try to intercede. Now let's look, if you will, chapter 19, verse 1. And Saul spake to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should slay David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeketh to slay thee. Now therefore, I pray thee, take heed to thyself in the morning, and abide in a secret place, and hide thyself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art, and I will commune with my father of thee, and if I see aught, I will tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he hath not sinned against thee, and because his works have been to thee were very good. But what is it that Saul then wants to do to David? All right, he wants him dead. In verse 8, it says, And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great number. And they fled before him. And an evil spirit from Jehovah was upon Saul, and as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing with his hand, and Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Mark it down. That's twice. Yes.
I find it interesting that in verse 6,
The man of honor that he has become, yes. Yeah, quite a little bit of a flip-flop, yes. No, I'm not going to do anything to David. But now, yeah, I'm going to try to kill him. Yeah. Well, read on just a little bit. We've noted that Michael loved David. Now, that didn't make things a whole lot better as far as Saul and David's relationship is concerned. She knows that Saul is intent on killing David. And David has to go. And so what does Michael, his wife, do? All right, helps him down through a window, helps him to escape there, beginning in verse 12 and the next several verses. And so David fled. When Saul finds out that David has fled, and he challenges his daughter about David now being gone, how does she explain it? All right, he was sick, yeah. But now that he's not here anymore, he's gone. How does she explain it? Ah, so she's explaining it that David did what? He threatened to kill me if I didn't help him. Well, now that wasn't so. He didn't threaten to kill her. But that's how she explains it to her father. And the text tells us in verse 18 that he fled and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah. Now, I'm going to jump ahead and test, see who's reading very far ahead. What did Saul do with Michal while David's on the run? You what? He married her off. That's right. He did. Did it take? Okay. David came back and got her. Yeah, he did. He came back and got her. Yeah.
Well, it took him the fact that when David came back and got her, her husband was just broken hearted about the whole time.
Oh, that was terrible. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. He was, yeah.
So I can't imagine that if Michal was mean to the second husband that he would have been all broken hearted about the thing. So
yeah. Yeah, well, he probably did. But it didn't last. David came back and got her. And she was David's wife. And David came back and got her. We might reason and say that when Saul married off his daughter Michal to this second man, could we say that was unlawful? Yeah, we might could say that. She was David's wife. Oh, yeah, if you're the king, that don't make any difference, okay? Well, Saul continues to pursue David. As we come into the second chapter, oh, one other thought. I don't want to miss this. When David has fled from Saul and come to Ramah, we note in this instance that it's revealed that, the text tells us in verse 19 that Samuel went and dwelled in Naoth. And it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah." And Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as head over them, what happened now to the messengers that Saul sent? They started prophesying. Well, Saul sends other messengers, and what happened to them? They started prophesying. And Saul sent messengers a third time, and what happened to them? They started prophesying. And so Saul was so upset, this is a very loose paraphrase. He said, "Well, I'll just go myself." And lo and behold, what happened to Saul? He started prophesying. Now, wouldn't you think that that might kind of get next to you a little bit when you're trying to do evil things and it's just not turning out that way. In chapter 20, David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life?" And he said unto him, Far from it, that thou shalt not die. Behold, my father doeth nothing, either great or small, but that he discloseth it unto me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Well, now that's just Very interesting. Jonathan does not believe that Saul is intent on taking David's life. But is he? Oh, very much so. Very much so. In verse 3, David sware moreover and said, "Thy father knoweth well that I have found favor in thine eyes." And he said, "Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as Jehovah liveth and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death." Now, David is very much convinced that Saul is trying to kill him. Jonathan is not so much convinced that he's trying to kill him. But nonetheless, David and Jonathan make a covenant between the two that any information that comes Jonathan's way, Jonathan's going to pass that on to David. In verse 15 of the text, he said, "But also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when Jehovah hath cut off the enemies of David, everyone from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "And Jehovah will require it at the hand of David's enemies." We are reading here about the content of this covenant that Jonathan makes with David. Jonathan is going to do everything that he can do to spare David's life. Now, on into the 20th chapter. Missed something. On into the 20th chapter. If you'll pick up the reading. At about verse 24. Verse 24. It tells us, "So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat food." Let's paraphrase some of this for sake of time. We know that there was the observance of the feast of the new moon. The king would get all of his cohorts together and would celebrate this feast. David, of course, was presumed to be very close to Saul. And a family friend, as he and Jonathan were so close. And it would be expected that David would come to this family feast, would he not? And so the feast was planned. But Jonathan tells David, "You don't attend this feast. And your place at the table will be left empty." Now, when Saul asked, "Where's David?" Now observe, if you will, that this feast would last a few days. David did not appear at the table. And Jonathan says, when David inquires, or rather when Saul inquires as to the whereabouts of David, then I'll just explain that David has earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. Now why would he desire to go to Bethlehem? Jonathan explains. It's his hometown, that's right. And it's his desire to celebrate this feast with his family, you see. Going to make a family occasion out of this. So that'll soothe down Saul's ruffled feathers because he doesn't see you at the table. But rather than for Saul to say, "That's okay, it's a family thing, I understand," what does he do in terms of reaction? He is very angry. Very angry. In fact, he said, "For as long," verse 31, "as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die." Now, Saul is saying this to Jonathan. As long as David lives, you won't get to be king. What is it that knows about David? David's going to be the next king. Saul knows that. So as long as David lives, Jonathan, my beloved son, you'll not get to be king. So we've got to kill David. Now that's just the way it is. David must die. And Jonathan intercedes. In verse 32, his question is, "Wherefore should he be put to death? What hath he done?" And how does Saul react to his own son? And now he's trying to kill him. He threw the javelin or the spear at Jonathan, trying to nail him to the wall. Pardon me? No.
he's still trying to thwart the will of God.
Yep. Yep.
As if there's some way that John can still get that crown.
Yep. And that's why he's still sitting on the throne.
Why?
Yeah. He's got the power, and God's letting him run his race. And we're going to see how that ends tragically. That's true. That's true. Yes, that's very true. All right. No. Oh, no. No. Very good point. Well, Jonathan's got the message now when his own father throws the javelin at him trying to kill him. In verse 34, Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did eat no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. Now, that's abundantly clear to Jonathan. He's got the message. Now, beginning in verse 35 through the end of the chapter, David and Jonathan have an understanding that Jonathan is going to do some target practice. And he takes his bow and his arrows and he shoots them, and it's understood that if I say to the lad that retrieves my arrows that the arrows are farther out there, then you go. And if I say the arrows are over here, then everything's okay, you can come. All right? And when Jonathan shoots the arrows, he says to the lad, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" And in verse 38, Jonathan cried after the lad, "Make speed, haste, stay not." Now, if you had this understanding with Jonathan and you were David, would that language be the least bit ambiguous to you? It's time to run. My father's going to kill you. Now, you'll note that the lad, he didn't understand all of that, verse 39, but Jonathan and David did. And Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad, and they were to be put away. But in verse 41, it says, "As soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of a place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times. And they kissed one another and wept one for the other until David exceeded. And Jonathan said to David, 'Go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of Jehovah, saying, Jehovah shall be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever.' And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city." Now, chapter 21 begins the flight, if you please, of David from place to place to place to place to place to try to get away. Now, I want to review just a little bit. We note that in chapter 19 that David has fled to Ramah to see Samuel. Saul's messengers prophesy three times. We noted at the end of that chapter, Randy, that Saul also prophesied. So we know what God's will is for Saul. And then here we are again. He goes to Nob in chapter 21. Notice that this is not all that far away from Ramah to Nob. Something probably just guesstimating in the neighborhood of less than 10 miles thereabouts. So, but he's on the run. He's running away. And in chapter 21, it says, "Then David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest." Remember who Ahimelech is. Ahimelech the priest. "And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said unto him, 'Why art thou alone, and no man with thee?' And David said unto Ahimelech the priest, 'The king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, Let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed the young men to such and such a place.'" Well, be that as it may, had the king necessarily appointed David on the king's business? No, he surely had not. David is on the run. And what he needs from the priest, Ahimelech, is help. He needs something to eat. He needs something to fight with. But what does the priest have to eat? Consecrated bread. All right. What kind of shape is David in? He's all tuckered out. Well put, Richard. He's all tuckered out. We find reference made to this in Matthew chapter 12, there in verse 4. And what's the purpose of the Lord's reference to this? All right. Let's go to Matthew. Look it up. Chapter 12, verse 4. All right. All right. Now we want to ask ourselves a question. The occasion that's prompted this to be used as an illustration is that Jesus and his disciples went through the grain fields on the Sabbath day, and they plucked grain and they ate on the Sabbath day. Now, they're accused of violating the Sabbath day. Now, Jesus points out, well, it's not lawful to eat the showbread, but only for the priest. But when David came to what was then called the temple, this is not the temple in Jerusalem, but the place where the tabernacle was housed, the temporary place of what later became the temple, I shall say. And he came to Ahimelech. What shape was he in, he and his men? They were starving. They were about to die from hunger. And what did Ahimelech do for them? He gave them showbread to eat. Now, we know that this showbread was showbread that was to be replaced. If you read in the text, verse 6 is of chapter 21, so the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before Jehovah to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. Now, there's a qualifying factor there. The showbread that the priest fed to David and to his men was the showbread that had been removed from before Jehovah that it might be replaced with the fresh showbread. But, go ahead.
And I think the idea was that the showbread was going to be eaten by the priest.
Yes.
And so he gave them something that was going to be eaten by the priest anyway. And Matthew said that when the priests eat this, according to the tradition of men, they profane the Sabbath. But when in fact God has shown that they don't profane the Sabbath, simply by eating this bread on the day that he told them they could eat it.
All right. That's true. What? Okay. So we're clear on that. Sometimes we stumble on that. It's not a point really we need to stumble on. But David was hungry, and Ahimelech gave him something that in fact was lawful to give him, but might have been perceived by some to be unlawful to give him. And as we read in the text further, in verse 7 of chapter 21, beginning in verse 7, we'll not take the time to read all of that, but David's not there only for bread, but what else does he need? He needs weapons. But what does Ahimelech the priest have as a weapon? Goliath's sword. David has experience with that, doesn't he? Maybe not much, but that's all that's there. And that's the finest weapon that there is. And so that'll do. Now that's a very loose paraphrase of verse 8. So we find that David used or left with Goliath's sword. Yes. I don't know if I can answer that. I don't really see a time line from the time that we have Goliath killed, or in fact, from the time that Saul kind of begins to mess up until the time that, I guess it would be about the time that David becomes king. And we know in the beginning of some of Saul's exploits, about chapter 13, we saw the question there of about what point in Saul's reign did those events occur. And I think that it can be somewhat so concluded early on in his reign, though that's not set in stone. But then that doesn't give us a timeline. We know that Saul reigned for about 40 years, for 40 years. So exactly where these events fit, I'm not certain. But let me just throw this out. If we put the events on a timeline and just say approximate their place, we're getting close to the end of Saul's life. And so we'd probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of, now again, I'm just guessing, on the latter 10 years or so, maybe even more, of Saul's life. Right.
And so, yeah, like you say, if we look at at 13 and all that sort of stuff, it appears that that's toward the beginning of Saul's reign. And then here we're looking at something toward the end of Saul's reign.
Yeah.
So a number of years must have passed.
Yeah. We've got these things bookend, and we've got all these events. We've got them somewhat in order. Well, they are in order. But as to how much time lapsed between them, I don't know. I don't know. Well, yeah. Yeah, he's better with a sword, yeah.
I was going to say, just a curious thing, back when...
That's an interesting observation.
A curious translation of the King James Version, back when talking about the young man picking up Jonathan's bow and arrows and taking them back home.
Mm-hmm.
The King James Version uses the word artillery.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
The commentator here says that the King James people looked at the translation and said, well, that word talks about something that's capable of propelling something at a great distance.
Yeah.
That's why they used the word artillery.
Well, that's true. And from what I understand as fact of ancient warfare, what they did with these archers is you may have 1,000. Going off at once. So it's not like we've got an archer up here like we see on the TV with the cowboys and Indians. We've got an Indian over here shooting an arrow into somebody. We've got a multitude of archers that are, we've just got a hailstorm of arrows coming down. That would satisfy a definition of artillery, like a catapult or a cannon. We're taking out a bunch of folks at one time. I saw a hand. Randy or Donna? Yes. Yes.
And not only that, but the training and the weapons of choice, what they're comfortable with, what they can use, it evidently solves is the javelin or the spear.
Well, yes.
His expertise is the law.
Well, we might not want to call him an expert at this point, but... Yeah. Well, now that's right. She's brought up something that provides us an occasion to go back and remember. Deuteronomy 4. Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy 28 through 30. Then Joshua. All of it. Joshua 21 and Joshua 23 in particular. You see, all of these Old Testament passages that we are looking at and have specifically mentioned warned them of what would happen if you don't keep my statutes and ordinances. And what's happened to Saul? Has he kept the commandments of God? No. Didn't Samuel tell Saul that if you had kept the commandments of God, he could have established your kingdom forever? But you didn't do that. So yes, you have the element of God's providence in all of this. The timeline and everything is the factor of the providence of God, when to bring all this to pass. And yes, when we see Jonathan warning David, it's time to leave, and we see David go to Nob, to the house of Ahimelech, and Ahimelech provides him something to eat. And you know, no one of these elements is to be eliminated from the overall provision of God to do just exactly what He said He would do. Bruce? All right. All right, that's right. That's right. So David now, his physical needs have been met. He has food, he has a weapon, he has Goliath's sword. And then the text tells us in chapter 21 and verse 10 that he went to Gath. Now, let me do that one more time. Look at where Gath is. You know, when you study history and geography, you'd read right over this in the text, unless you had the map in front of you. Where's Gath? It's in the province of Philistia. It is a Philistine city. Do you see that, Jenny? Indeed it is. It is a Philistine city. And who lives there? One in particular. Pardon me? Achish. Who in the world is Achish? He's the king. That makes him a pretty important character here in among the Philistines, doesn't it? Why in the world does David go to the Philistines and live among the Philistines? Get away from Saul. Well, won't they find out that David is an Israelite? And won't they want then to kill David? Well, yeah. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing. He's got our champion sword. He's the guy that killed Goliath. Uh-huh. All right.
But then they've got to be concerned about what happens if they realize that, okay, we're Hebrews, we should be fighting with the Hebrews and go back and cause problems.
All right.
But so they couldn't live there.
All right. Well, he did for a short time this time, but then later he came and lived among the Philistines for over a year. In fact, Achish was one of his buddies. Now, I want you to read that for next time. We'll talk about David among the Philistines in our next study. Okay? Yeah. Well, you'd like to think, at least among some of them, but not all of them. Okay? Pardon me? Well, yeah. Yeah, so there you are on the cliff. Now, don't you want to read on further in chapter 22 and farther? Okay, in fact, start there and read on down through the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. Okay, all the way through the rest of the book.